Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Although in the feed it may say this is episode 99, that's only because I had to restart the feed when I built everything up from scratch again a year and a half ago. So it is 99, but it is also episode probably 400 or 500. I just passed my 8th anniversary of going on the air at CGSF at SFU back in February of 2010, and minus my 6-week stint in the Galapagos in 2016, it's been pretty much consistent ever since. But this is a big episode, for a number of reasons. Recovering Black History Month. And I'm also talking about one of the most anticipated movies of the year, Black Panther. And I also delve into other nerdy topics with my guest. And my guest is Andre Demise. For Canadian podcast listeners and for political junkies, you may remember Andre as one of the original co-hosts of Canada Land back in 2016 with Desmond Cole. But he's very heavily involved in the community. He ran for municipal government a couple years back, and he also organized a fundraiser screening for Black Panther for African-American youth, which is why I initially had him on the show. We were going to talk about, you know, Black Panther and all things Marvel, and we get into James Bond and superheroes, but we also talk on a lot more serious subjects. We talk about, you know, poverty reduction, what qualifies as racism, what the, you know, how he feels the Canadian government is, how they've been doing in their response to a lot of the different things we've been seeing. And so this, I think this podcast does a lot of good in not only talking about those issues, which are crucial, but also looking at diversity in the nerd community and examining a lot of these films that we're seeing, whether they're, you know, superhero films or, you know, fantasy genre, stuff like that. Examining them from a different lens than we just might see, you know, from a white nerd or a queer nerd, for example. So I had a lot of fun talking with Andre, and so here it's about a 90-minute interview, so it'll be a good one. It actually moves pretty fast. So here is my conversation with Andre Demise. Andre Demise, hello.
How's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
So I wanted to have you on. You know, Black History Month is coming up, but I wanted to get your opinion on that term, because, you know, somebody like Morgan Freeman came out years ago and said he doesn't celebrate it. He feels that it cheapens Black history in terms of sort of having it as a token. What are your thoughts on the actual term itself?
Well, the term itself comes from Carter G. Woodson, who believed that education that was taking place in the U.S. and the Reconstruction and the post-Civil War period was cheap. Well, that was cheapening our history, not understanding where we'd come from, because our lives and our family histories were literally stolen from us. So he wrote a book called The Miseducation of the Negro, where he talked about the U.S. education system underserving Black people for a very long time. Even on the plantations outside of the United States, we weren't allowed to read. And the education that we received was very Eurocentric and very colonial. So I understand what Morgan Freeman's context was that, you know, why should we have a Black History Month when, you know, having 1 month set out of the year towards Black History, I guess in his opinion, cheapens it. To me, it's kind of indicative of the fact that we don't teach a full history. We don't teach an accounting of history from outside of a Eurocentric perspective. So it makes sense that you would have, it started off as a week and then gradually blossomed into a month. You'd have a time of the year set aside so that young Black people who attend an education system that, like I said, is very heavily steeped in Eurocentrism, get to understand a little bit more and understand more about themselves. What I grew up with in the 1980s was mostly North American Black history. So I learned about like the Black Battalion that Canada, the Reconstruction Battalion that we sent off to World War I. I learned some of the history of Africville and Halifax, but I didn't learn a heck of a lot outside of Canadian and U.S. History of Black bondage. Now what we're seeing is a much wider depth of knowledge going into the histories of certain African cultures, where exactly in West Africa most of us were kidnapped from, etc. So I think that it's actually expanded quite a bit in my lifetime, what it is that we're able to learn and glean from the month of February.
You know, when I was growing up, in terms of that, I learned mainly about the Americans' role in slavery, not so much about Canada and the Black Nova Scotians and all mm-hmm. that. What do you think the educational system needs to do to make young people more aware and more knowledgeable of that part of our history?
I would say that we need to learn to let go of things that could be embarrassing. So when I learned about the history of Africville, all I knew was that there were Black people that ended up in Nova Scotia because they were loyalists during the American Revolutionary War. What I didn't understand was that they were essentially forced to fight, and then once they did fight, the British reneged on their promise to allot them a parcel of land and allow them to grow on it. They actually were just given like the most inhospitable spit of land, and even that was taken away from them. So there's a real defensiveness, I think, to the way that we teach history. We know colonialism was an historical evil. But I think that a lot of people are very uncomfortable standing on that side of that, knowing that the history that they benefited from was an actual evil history. Is it, you know, not the history of westward Christian expansion, but the history of rape and genocide, starvation, and, you know, it's, I can understand that would be a lot to take in. Growing up thinking that you were descended from the good guys and you really weren't. I think letting that go and understanding history in its context is key, because yeah, absolutely, there's a certain privilege to growing up as somebody who was able to settle as a colonist, as somebody who was able to subsume themselves into whiteness. At the same time, by trying to teach it from a strictly Eurocentric perspective, what you're saying is, well, your own history is not as important. So to say to Indigenous people that your own history pre-colonial contact was not important, to say to Black people that your own history in Africa was essentially that you were civilized by the white man, is as pure students of history, you would expect that people wouldn't want to hear that. They would just simply want to hear the story as it occurred, not as the way that people want it to be told. You know, it took me a long time to find out exactly where in West Africa my family, you know, where my family came from. I actually thought that the ships that transported African slaves to Jamaica had come from Nigeria. I grew up thinking that, but they actually came from Ghana. And, you know, my family is actually able to trace, like, the tribe that we came from in Ghana. So it's kind of sucks that we have to find that out on our own, that we have to spend our own time and money to figure that kind of stuff out, because it's simply not taught. But I think that teaching more about Black achievements in history helps add to the historical, I guess, like a tapestry. You know, it's super important to me that we understand everyone's history and not just understand history from a narrow perspective.
I remember during the 2008 presidential election, candidate Denis Kucinich saying that he was alone among the candidates and that he was for reparations mm-hmm. for the Black community. Is that something that is a realistic expectation?
Realistic expectation. That's a interesting way to put it. I don't know about whether the expectation is realistic or not. We simply know that the debt exists. And it's not just the American reparation for slavery that's in question. It's the British reparations for slavery that's owed to Jamaicans. You know, the British are more than happy to spend millions of pounds building a prison facility in Jamaica, but not to recompense people who benefited British labor. There are, you know, members of the landed British gentry that we celebrate, people like Benedict Cumberbatch, who finds out that his family benefited from slavery in Barbados. You know, I don't know whether I have an opinion as to whether or not it's realistic, because I simply don't know how much money all of these countries have to spend. But I do know that the debt exists. We have the paperwork. We do know that France robbed Haiti of what today would be somewhere in the range of about $40 billion US. We know that because they sent gunboats to Haiti and demanded reparations for the theft of their property being Haitian slaves. We do know that America robbed African Americans of their birthright. They were promised land that they never received. And even after the Reconstruction era and after the Civil Rights era, we have the receipts to show that they were in places where they were able to grow prosperous communities, that they were burnt down. In areas where they succeeded, money was stolen from them. In areas where they were able to buy real estate, the real estate was pulled out from under their feet. There's a lot of scholarship. A lot of people sort of got keyed into the history of American reparations, or the possibility of reparations, through Ta-Nehisi Coates' essay, The Case for Reparations. But that information has existed for decades, and it's been, you know, talked about by scholars going all the way back to the 1960s. So I don't know whether I have an opinion as to whether it's realistic. I do have an opinion on whether that debt is owed, and it simply is.
You know, in the last couple of years, the government, you know, said, okay, we're gonna do this reconciliation project with the indigenous community. Do you see parallels between that and the African American community, and do you think we can see something like that towards them in the future with what Trudeau did with the indigenous?
I mean, I think that there's a definite truth and reconciliation process that's required for the United States, for Canada, for the British colonies as well. It's really up to anyone to decide how effective that is. I mean, we, at least with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that took place in Canada, we can point to documents because they're there, they're available online, they're free, and the website is fairly prominent. You Google TRC, it's the first result that comes up. And you can take a read through the documents going all the way back to Confederation to show that, you know, there's been a centuries-long process of essentially isolating, quarantining, and then attempting genocide on Indigenous Canadians. That information is out there. That's, I think, a good that came out of the Truth and Reconciliation process. One thing that I think that hasn't been followed, and I don't know if it ever will be, is following through on the UN Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the UNDRIP recommendations. We had the current government come into power saying that they are going to adhere to the UNDRIP recommendations, and they obviously haven't. You know, we're still snatching Indigenous children away from their parents' arms and putting them into foster care. One of the most ridiculous stats that I saw was a lady who received $600 a month from government welfare, and her child was taken from her home because she simply didn't have enough money to care for her child, and then placed into a home, received $1,500 a month for care of that child. So it's like the government's willing to spend money on taking children away from their parents' arms and then putting that money into the hands of people who would then be placed as those children's caretakers, but we're simply not willing to honor our treaty obligations to Indigenous people. And I think that there are some parallels there, but it's a bit of a different story in the sense that for Indigenous people, this land belonged to them in the first place, you know, and the rest of us moved in and declared it our land. With Black people, we were stolen from our lands and cut off from our. I think one thing that's very important to take into account is that Indigenous people in North America and Indigenous people, especially in West Africa, in areas of like Nigeria, Benin, Ghana, etc., have a very deep spiritual tie to the lands where they live. That's very similar for both of us. So for Indigenous people to have their land robbed from them, and also for Black people to be taken away from their land, had the same sort of traumatic effect on both groups of people. But I think there is a distinct difference in the sense that as a descendant of kidnap Ghanaians that ended up in Jamaica and then immigrated to Canada. In a sense, I'm a settler in a way. Whereas for an Indigenous Canadian, they belonged here. They were here for long before anybody else got here, and have seen the amount of their territory shrink and shrink continuously. So there's a lot of similarities, but there's a lot of differences. But I do believe that a reconciliation process does have a lot of benefits. At least it brings all of the information and all the truth out there.
Let's talk about visibility, because one of the really awesome things that you're doing is you arranged a screening of Black Panther for Toronto's African-American youth. And I know you're a bit of a geek. me too. What is it about that film in particular you think that is so important?
Oh, man. How far back do you want to go here? Okay, so and it wasn't... Like, it wasn't me that organized the event. It was the Black Business and Professionals Association, who was, you know, it was myself and another board member who brought a recommendation to the board to say, hey, this movie's coming out. It looks pretty awesome. Wouldn't it be great if we got a bunch of Black youth to go out and see this this film? And we had no idea where the money was going to come from. Being a charity, we don't have a lot of extra cash sitting on hand, just like every other charity. Like, it's a scramble every year to get funding for any kind of charity. So we didn't have the amount of money needed to bring even like 50 or 100 youth to go see this film. We said, okay, well, maybe we could put up a crowdfunder and talk to Cineplex and see if we can get a discount on the rental fees and then work this all out. We took it to crowdfunding and talked about it on Twitter, Facebook, etc., and said, hey guys, you know, we're raising funds to take Black youth to the screening. The thing is, movie tickets today are super expensive. I don't know how families do it. Like, you know, it's $16.50 for the 3D seat. And then, like, it's another, like, $12 or so for the popcorn and the drinks, etc. So, like, one seat's $30. And we figured, okay, well, $30 a seat, a theater that we can get for 200 people will probably cost us about $6,000, somewhere in that range, once you consider fees, taxes, etc. So our goal was $6,000. In the first 8 hours of the crowdfunding going public, we raised about 13,000. So we're currently sitting at close to $16,000 now. And, you know, it's being that we almost tripled our goal. That's amazing. And we thought about getting more tickets for more youth to go to more theaters. And that would have been great. Except, what do we do after that? Like, the kids get to go see this movie and everyone gets inspired and that's amazing. And then what happens? So we figured we could speak to people in Toronto's film industry to find out if there's ways to get youth who are interested in making movies, whether it's writing scripts or directing or just being the camera person or whatever, like getting in front of the camera. How can we get young people inspired by this film to create more awesome stories like this, to create more movies so that they can see themselves represented? So we got to work with a group called Indigenous and Creatives of Color in TV and Film. And they're going to be offering workshops at the BBPA Center for Excellence downtown, near Bay and Elm Street. And on Saturday mornings, youth get to come out there and work on every different aspect of film. We even have like a stunt class that's going to be taking place with like an actual stunt actress leading the classroom. So it's been pretty, the response has been absolutely amazing.
Well, you know, there's Black Panther, Black Lightning just came out. Yeah. We have Blackish or Blackish, Grownish, and of course the success of Get Out.
Right.
For you, what is it, where do you think we are in terms of that, you know, visibility and diversity of African-American voices on screen? Now, of course, Jordan Peele getting the nominations, Ziara Shahidi, Anthony Anderson. Is it looking up going forward, do you think?
Well, the thing is, I'm old enough to remember the late 1980s, early 1990s, when, to me, that was like the golden age of Black voices in film and television. And I still kind of feel like I saw more representation back when I was young as compared to now. I remember in the early 2000s, like, representation was almost non-existent. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but, you know, the TV and film industry made a big bet on Black audiences in the early 90s, and it seemed to pay off until it didn't. What I'm seeing now is, I think, sort of a resurgence, and this happens probably every 20 years or so, when TV and film producers realize, oh, wait a second, Black people have money too, and they also have TV sets. They'll actually watch things that we put on that cater to that audience. I think it's amazing that you know, Jordan Peele being the first person to receive 3 Oscar nominations in the same year. But then it's also kind of sad that it took until 2018 for a black person to receive 3 Oscar nominations in the same year. I think it's great that we're seeing TV shows like, you know, Black Lightning, movies like Black Panther, TV shows like Blackish, Grownish, Insecure, Atlanta. Like, all of this is amazing. But I don't think I'm ever going to be satisfied with what we have. Because if you look at Nielsen rating or Nielsen studies, year after year, it shows that if you have diversity in front of and behind the cameras, a film or a TV show will just do better. Accounting for all other factors, as long as the people that are on the film posters and the people who are doing the filming are a diverse group, the movie will make money. And the reason is because people want to be able to watch a movie and feel like I could see myself as that person one day. We got some of the contest entries for the Black Youth screening that's going to be happening for the Black Panther movie. Because what we asked people to do was to register. If you could also please update or upload, whether it's like a short essay or a poem, like your cosplay pictures, video, whatever you want to do, music, just tell us, why are you excited to see this film? And some of the responses that we got, like, just absolutely melted my heart. Like, seeing like this a couple of black siblings, and they talked about, like, I want to see Black Panther because he's amazing. And then they put the mask on and stuff, and I was like, oh, gosh, the feelings, too many feelings. So I think all of this is great. I would just like to see more of it.
What do you think, though, as a film fan, the impact that winning the Best Picture Oscar for Moonlight, the impact that had on black voices, young voices, and even gay black voices? What did a film like that do? Do you think?
Oh boy. So, intra community conversations are really difficult thing. Like, every conversation that's happening in mainstream happens within black communities as well. Like, we're not a monolith. We don't all have one voice. There are gay black people, there are trans black people, there are queer black people of every stripe. But then there's also black people that are homophobic. There are black people that are less tolerant. There are black people who have this like breed of toxic masculinity sort of ingrained in the culture. So being, and I don't talk about this very often, but I myself am bisexual, and I saw myself represented when I saw the film Moonlight. I actually reviewed it for the Globe and Mail when it premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. And it touched a chord in me that I don't think any movie had ever done, is that I really felt every emotion that the main character, Cheyenne Wong, was feeling as the film progressed. Everything from being the youth that got picked on for being small, for being called a sissy, for, you know, in high school, just being really awkward and having a difficult time relating to people, especially to people who kind of have what we want, which is like popularity, especially like popularity with the girls, etc. And then growing into a full-grown man that has just covered himself in all this emotional scar tissue and has just shut the world out and portrays himself as like this powerful figure that nobody can ever fuck with. There was something in each act of that film that I could deeply relate to. And I thought, you know, if this picture doesn't win Best Film, like, what are we even doing? Why does anybody ever get behind a camera? And, I mean, we're all familiar with the fiasco where, you know, the wrong film got announced as, you know, for best picture. But, you know, that's all behind us. I think what that did, I think what the director Barry Jenkins did, I think what that film did for black audiences is show that there's so much more depth to our culture than the way that we've typically been portrayed. You know, a lot of times for... and Octavia Spencer's talked about this. She actually has an interview where she does discuss it. Getting portrayed as like the helper, you know, for black women especially, like you're the person who helps a white character achieve their goal. Getting portrayed as like a stern, no nonsense judge or doctor or manager of some kind, like somebody who's like stern and aloof and completely above and totally unrelatable. Then there's the black person that ends up being like the hard scrabble, like just trying to get ahead in life. Like there's always a portrayal of us. Sorry, that's...
No worries.
I'm just going to close the door quickly.
Yeah. Boy, podcast etiquette. You got to turn your phone down, bruh.
Is that a Doctor Who ringtone?
That was a Doctor Who ringtone.
Yeah, all right.
All right, so yeah, that's... I think that what we're seeing now is just a depth to characterization that exists in the community that we just didn't get to see before. in film and television. I think all of that is great. I think what Moonlight did was essentially like crack open a barrier where we get to explore all these different facets of our humanity besides just the ones that are okay to show to people, like that tough exterior that we always have to carry around. We actually get to be real live, living, breathing human beings.
You know, speaking of the intersectionality of that movie, the Black Lives Matter movement here was one that got a lot of coverage. And in Vancouver, too, where I'm originally from, in terms of that group's conversations that had with pride and all that. What do you make of you know where that conversation went? Because it felt like whatever the cops decided to do, they weren't going to win.
Well, I have a lot of feelings about that one because you know I'm not, how am I going to put this? I don't consider myself like an active member of the LGBTQ community. It's something that I don't really, you know, talk about myself very often, don't really express it. Not because I'm trying to hide anything, but just because to me, sexuality is a personal thing. That's just for me. But one thing that I really could deeply relate to was, you know, I was seeing on Facebook posts, and I was seeing my friends talk about this on social media, and this was happening for, that I was aware of. It was happening all the way back to the beginning of last year. And I'm pretty sure the conversation was happening way before that. It's just that that's when I started catching wind of it, was gay men disappearing, like just vanishing. And it's tough because I have family members that worked in the social services sector, close family members, you know, that worked in group homes, runaway shelters, etc. And you could see the moment that someone loses so much hope that they decide to run away from their family. A lot of the time it's because of sexual abuse, but oftentimes it was because they were somewhere on the queer spectrum and the families couldn't accept that. And running away for that reason, I think out of a sense of personal safety, is completely different than being inside of a community where you feel safe and then disappearing from that too. That is weird. And the Toronto police, it seemed like they were not taking it seriously. Like people were bringing concerns to them saying, hey, my friend has disappeared. My coworker has disappeared. And that's just completely out of character for them, that they would just up and disappear like that. And it seemed like Toronto police were just brushing this off. And then when they found out that it actually had been a man who killed, that we know of, two people, and saying that he may have killed more, like that tore my heart apart. Because it felt like the police were so much more invested in being seen to be aligned with the LGBTQ movement when it involved positive press. When it meant that they could march alongside people in the Pride Parade and shoot water guns at people in their uniforms and just be seen as like these really like happy-go-lucky, cool people. And then all of a sudden Black Lives Matter shows up and, oh my gosh, they're telling us that we can't march in uniform. Like, well, aren't we supposed to be part of the community as well? And aren't we supposed to be, you know, looking out for everyone's well-being? Like, isn't everyone welcome at this parade? So it seemed like everyone was getting their feelings so hurt. And what a lot of people don't understand about Black Lives Matter organizers is that they themselves are often coming from LGBTQ backgrounds. They themselves have, like, they know what it's like to be oppressed, not just by the police, but by their own community as well. Like, to be told that they're not welcome in the church, to be told that they're not welcome in their own homes. The way I saw the conversation go was people were talking about Black Lives Matter. It's like, oh, well, why are they inserting themselves into this LGBTQ thing? As though black queer people don't exist. As though black queer people don't also have rights and haven't also faced oppression at the hands of police and don't also have, I mean, just a, you know, few months before that, many Black Lives Matter activists were camped out in front of Toronto Police headquarters. And as far as what the video showed and as far as what I was able to gather, like, they, you know, they, the police, tore down their tents, tore down the fixtures, and I guess it sprayed some sort of like chemical compound to get rid of the fires. But some of them got it on their skin and in their eyes. So some of them were deeply affected by this. Whereas just, you know, months before, they had been rousted at the hands of police, and then they're expected to march alongside them at the Pride Parade. So I can understand why they were angry and why is it that the police have to be involved in everything. But I could, in a sense, understand where some police officers, especially those who are LGBTQ also, said that they wanted to march in their uniforms to show that, hey, listen, like, Toronto Police has its issues, but we're accepted inside of the force and we're here to protect people. I can understand that to the extent that they would also want to participate. I just didn't understand why they had to be in the uniforms with their guns at the parade. That's just my personal thing. What I really didn't appreciate was when being aligned with the LGBTQ community had PR benefits, the police were all over it. But at the same time, when the LGBTQ community is coming to them saying, hey, there's people that we know are disappearing, like we haven't heard from them again, that there's a trans woman that disappeared and then was just, you know, her remains were found, but nobody knew who the remains belonged to until months after the fact. The police just seemed so lackadaisical in protecting the community, which is what they were supposed to be doing and why they were supposed to be marching. It's like they just didn't even care. So it really gets on my nerves when a group of people who's known to be violent towards a community says that I should be able to march right alongside you because I'm there with you. And then when you go to them for help, they don't care. That hurts.
I was listening to Jesse earlier today, and on his latest episode, he was talking about how with Bruce McCarthy and all the disappearances in the village, the police didn't really do anything until Andrew, the white man, disappeared. And that's when they started acting. What are your thoughts about that? And does that maybe indicate still a fundamental problem within the system itself?
mean, you draw your own conclusions. Obviously, me personally, do I think so? Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the Toronto police had to discipline an officer for yelling a slur at a gay person last. Like, this shit still happens. It's not like it went anywhere. It just became the smiling face that the police want to put on television to assure everybody that, hey, we're here for your safety. And in a lot of cases, no, they're not. I know what it's like growing up in a community like, you know, where I grew up in Rexdale, hearing the police superintendent, Ron Tavener, talk about, oh my gosh, violence in Toronto is so awful and we got to do something about it. At the same time, I mean, like, I remember, you know, my own friends being draped up by Ron Tavener's squad back when I was growing up, like coming out of the barbershop and then getting, like, you know, patted down for weed. So I'm trying to be as diplomatic as I can be here, but it's hard for me also to not think that they're just full of shit. And I got nothing positive to say about that.
In terms of, you know, getting assaulted by police and with everything that we're seeing in culture in Hollywood, with the Me Too movement, what is the conversation about sort of consent and rights been among black youth these days? Are you involved in that conversation at all?
Oh boy. That's a deep conversation that I don't know that I have the bandwidth or the standing to really participate in. What I will say is that that's not a conversation just for the black community. That's a conversation for everybody. I think, how am I gonna put this? There's a lot of people that still, like, even into adulthood, in your teenage years, I can sort of kind of get it, but not really, because it wasn't really me as a teenager. But into adulthood, it's like they place so much of their personal worth in who they're able to have sex with. And we grow up in a culture that rewards just being your average mediocre human being with sex. And I personally, it's just something that I don't really relate to or understand. I'm just kind of like, if someone's into you, they're into you. And if they're not, they're not. And it should be pretty easy to tell. And you can simply just ask. I don't understand why this conversation is so difficult for people. I just, you know, I'm not going to say anything about, you know, for example, like Patrick Brown or other people that haven't really had their, like, we haven't really heard the full extent of the conversation. Like, we've heard the first bit of information, but whenever, like, cases like this come out, there's always more to follow. You know, even when the Harvey Weinstein allegations came out in the New York Times report, then there was like a string of them that followed afterwards. And then we realized, like, no, this is a pretty, like, there's a consistent pattern to all this. So I generally, myself, like to wait until the information comes out before I, you know, have a public opinion on it. But I think in the aggregate, this conversation on consent has kind of like gone down one of two tracks. One track is simply, can we finally agree that there's something completely wrong about the way that our culture approaches sex? And can we have more constructive conversations with young people about this so that they don't grow up into adults with these weird and fucked up ideas? And then there's another parallel track to that being, oh my gosh, we're all under attack. And if one, you know, if anybody, if somebody can be taken down with one allegation, then any of us can be taken down. And I think that there's a bit of like self-interest in that. There's a bit of special pleading in that, in the sense that it's almost like they're preemptively defending themselves from something that might happen to them. When really, like, all it comes down to is be with somebody who wants to be with you, and if they don't, they don't. That's just an area of masculinity that I personally don't get, but, you know, take that for what it's worth.
You know, speaking of political correctness, it's an interesting time talking about, you know, what is and isn't offensive. And I know last year you talked about that ill-advised Pepsi ad with Kendall Jenner. But I think there were two other ads that sort of made more news than that. One was the Dove commercial, and one was the H&M one. And I feel like those two are a little bit different, because the two models who were involved in those commercials actually spoke out in a way in defense of those ads. Well, the mom of the kid said she was okay with this, and the model in the Dove ad said she was okay with it.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Do we need to wait to hear from the people involved in those commercials before we sort of start jumping down the throats of the companies that make them?
No, not really. I get to have a personal opinion about what a child in a sweater that says "coolest monkey in the jungle." I get to have an opinion about that before
for sure. His
mother weighs in. But everyone approaches this almost like, here's this innocent person that decided to sign up for an advertisement, and then they're being bombarded with all this negative publicity, and that's not what the intent of it was. And I get all that. I've worked in business for a long time myself. I understand that. But behind that, there's all the decision makers who decided, hey, this is a really good idea. Let's put the Pepsi ad aside for a second, because I thought that was like a momentary thing that I got to make fun of, and I thought it was funny. But with the H&M ad, H&M is the second largest retailer in the world, the entire world, which means that any sort of global campaign has to have a lot of decision makers agreeing on something before it becomes an advertisement. From deciding which sweaters to put on these different children, to taking all of the photos, and then an art director has to sit down and look at all these photos and be like, yep, we're going to use that one, and that one, not that one. Yeah, oh yeah, this one's good. Let's get these together. And then after, you know, the pictures are chosen, then somebody actually has to like clean them up in order to make an advertisement out of it. And then the advertisement has to pass through like the marketing department, and they give the final okay. Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, go ahead, run with this one. There are so many hands that changed this picture from one to the next, and all of them said, yeah, this is a good idea. For a global company that makes this much money, that has this much writing on its reputation, for that one to get out, I don't really care what the mother of that child thinks. What I care about is, what is the competence of these people that actually approved this advertisement? Like, what were they thinking? Because at this point, if this had been the early 2000s, I could see that maybe this was just an oversight that happened. Oh yeah, we didn't really get the implication of putting this particular sweater on this particular child. We shouldn't have done that. But in the year 2018, after everything that we've been dealing with in the last 5 or 6 years, you have to know. And if you don't know, why do you have that job? So I don't know whether it's political correctness being shoved down anyone's throats. It's a simple matter of human empathy. Whether or not you believe that a black child looks like a monkey has no bearing on what the history of trying to compare black people to apes and primates and savages has been. That history exists. It's there. Just because you weren't told that doesn't mean it didn't happen. We know what happened because we live it. We live it growing up. I grew up having been called an ape or a monkey. I grew up having been called all kinds of names. My grandmother, when she moved onto the block in our neighborhood where I grew up, was the first black person on that block. It was surrounded by Italians who called her all kinds of names. Like, I don't care whether or not you understand this history. I do. And I was offended by it. Putting that sweater on that child was fucking offensive. And if you don't understand that, maybe you shouldn't have the job that you have that caters to literally millions of people across the globe. Most of whom, by the way, aren't white. But that's just my opinion.
What about the Dove, though? Because a lot of people felt that was taken out of context, because the screenshot was just the first black woman going into a white woman, but then after that it was that same white woman going into a Hispanic woman.
Yeah.
So did we need to show the whole ad, or should that have, what is your opinion on that one?
Generally, for a skincare company, probably somewhere you want to stay away from, especially after, you know, Nivea has had multiple ads showing the benefits of the skin lightening creams. And the thing is, like, this idea of lighter skin being more refined has been pushed in sub-Saharan Africa for eons, generations. It even exists in my own family. Colorism is a real thing. And maybe that section of the advertisement didn't portray what the way that people took it. But again, this is why you have very smart people working in your offices who might be able to spot that and be like, oh, wait a second, guys. Like, I know that this advertisement is cute and everything, but some people are going to take this the wrong way. Why don't we try another direction? I think that shows the importance of having a diverse team behind the camera that can spot these things out, point out these glaring errors, because then they don't make the mistake of putting this lady in the advertisement that's now in the awkward position of then having to defend it. That's, you know, that's a responsibility that the company should have. I think, especially we grew up in a society that's so heavily predicated on personal responsibility. Why is it that when big companies fuck up, they don't got to take responsibility for it? I think, you know, diversity is not just a tokenism. It's not just a keyword. There is an importance in having diverse people work in your offices because they will be able to help you not fuck up like this.
So there was an article in the National Post at the end of last year that was titled by Tristan, that was titled All the Innocuous Things That Became Racist in 2017. And I just wanted to get your opinion on a couple of them. Yeah. One that really intrigued me was people were calling Nikki Ashton when she was running for NDP leadership racist for quoting Beyonce lyrics. She said, like Beyonce says, to the left, without realizing like that song was co-written between her, yeah, Neo, and Norwegian songwriters.
Yeah. Okay, me personally, like my personal opinion on that, I was like, why do you care? It was a Beyonce song about kicking a guy out of her house. Like, I just didn't see what the big deal was. That's my opinion. I didn't see the big deal. I thought it was completely overblown.
There was an interesting case down at the Oregon Bach Festival about this white conductor. He has a black friend.
Yeah.
And his name is Matthew Halls. And the countertenor, black countertenor, was Rudyard Mobley. And so Halls briefly attempted his impression of a southerner saying, do you want some grits? Someone saw that and fired him.
Yeah.
And Mobley said, I didn't think it was racist. Nobody asked me. And nobody asked me, and that's racist. What do you make of that whole shebang?
I hadn't even heard of that till you told me just this moment. I'm gonna step back from that for a second and say, like, it's hard to on a case by case basis say, oh, this is racist or that's not racist or this is just insensitive and maybe that just wasn't well thought out. You know, there is a certain degree of nuance that's required in the conversation that generally doesn't exist. This is mostly discussed in social media, and social media does not reward nuance. Social media rewards outrage. I think that in any case where somebody could have said something to somebody else that can be perceived as racist or at least bigoted or insensitive or whatever you want to call it, yeah, you want to speak to the person who was the receiving end of it first to see how they feel. But sometimes how they feel is not that important in that moment anyway, i.e. with the H&M ad. How the mother feels is not important because this is something that H&M is saying to every black child, not just to the mother of this particular black child. But I think there's also times where we're so quick to jump the gun that, you know, people who didn't really intend anything, maybe this guy really does like grits. I don't know. I have no idea. But I think that that's also it's not just a product of social media outrage. It's a product of a society that doesn't handle these conversations very well. You have no idea the amount of defensiveness that I encounter, not when I try to talk to people about race, but when people come to me. I don't really go out talking to people about racial stuff. Like, anybody that knows me in my personal life, like, I might joke around with my family or friends and stuff like that, right? And say, like, this person's racist, whatever. But that's just between myself, my family, and my friends. They know I'm kidding. But generally, if it's like around work or people that I don't really know personally, I don't push my opinions on anybody else. People generally will come and ask me questions, and I'll give them my honest answer. And then when I say, okay, well, yeah, this is bigoted for this particular reason, the amount of defensiveness that I encounter, it's like, well, you came to me and asked this question, and I'm telling you why I happen to think that this was ignorant, and now you're getting angry at me about it. That's, I think, the big problem here, is that it's so hard for us to have simple conversations about what racism is or isn't that everything becomes a big conversation about what racism is or isn't.
What do you make of certain people who called Trudeau a white genocide terrorist, I think was the term I heard?
Oh my God, I didn't really hear that one.
Or what was it? What does it say here? Yusra Kogali, mm-hmm, decided to call him a white supremacist terrorist. because that he's a leader of a state founded on the genocide of black people, and that by inviting refugees turned away by the United States, he is trying to prolong the genocide of indigenous people. I think there's a lot going on in that statement.
There's a lot going on in that statement that I'm not willing to unpack, that's for sure.
Fair enough.
Do I think that he's a white supremacist terrorist? I don't think so. What I do think is that he's an opportunist who, you know, got elected on a promise that he made to indigenous people and hasn't kept it. And by not keeping it, has allowed the machinery of the Canadian settler colonial state to continue. I'm not so much angry at Trudeau as I am just profoundly disappointed. And it's just, that's not what I think people voted for. I personally didn't vote for him because I thought the jig was up the moment that he decided that he wanted Bill Blair to be part of the Liberal team. That was the moment for me where I was like, I washed my hands with this party. But I think that people did vote for him out of a profound sense of hope and needing to repair wounds that have been done under the Harper government. And so far, he's just been found wanting. Or, you know, everyone from Carolyn Bennett to Jane Philpott have been found wanting, and it's really disappointing to see that.
Do you think you'll ever run for office again?
Me?
Yeah.
Hell no. No. I don't think that would happen. I just don't see it. I'm a lot more comfortable in writing, and that's really where I wanted to be ultimately. I had a lot of things to say and a lot of feelings about the way that, you know, especially black people and poor people are treated in Canadian society. And I thought that that's what I wanted to accomplish by running for office. And then I was going to do that in my little neighborhood of Rexdale. And then the circus sort of came to town on that one. So would I run for office again? Probably not. I think I'm a lot more comfortable as a writer and a storyteller than I am as a politician.
I know your buddy Desmond is looking at running for mayor. Do you think he would make a good leader?
I think Desmond would be an excellent mayor. I think that a lot of what Desmond has to say is too difficult for people to hear to want to vote for him. But I think he'd be an excellent, because I think what people, let me just dial this back a second. I think one of the biggest problems with Toronto is that it's a very large city that forgets it's a large city. A lot of people in Toronto believe that Toronto should be the kind of place that they grew up in and haven't adapted to the change that the city has. Professor David Hilchansky released a series of pictures on his social media. He tweeted, this is what Toronto looked like as far as like the geography and then poverty, concentration of poverty and wealth. And the pictures show from like 1980, 1990, 2000, 2010. And what you'll see is like in this map, it's like a 3D map. And it shows high poverty area, median wealth, high wealth. And in the 1980s map, poverty was concentrated in like small pockets in Toronto, mostly towards the downtown core, around like the Parkdale area, around here, Leslieville. And then what you gradually see is the low income areas spreading outward into the suburbs, and then the median income areas being like in the far reaches originally, but then moving towards like the outskirts of downtown, and then the high wealth areas being concentrated fully into the downtown core. What this means over time is that policies that favor low taxes, policies that favor low user fees, policies that do not favor infrastructure or public transit or social housing, and those things that make a large city great, because we've spent so many years kicking that can down the road, avoiding raising taxes to make sure that we can actually like preserve our infrastructure, much less build new infrastructure, to make sure that community housing is an actual like livable place, to enforce housing regulations so that, let's say, if you put up a new condo, you also have to allot a certain amount of units to social housing. Like, having those common sense gestures in a large city just hasn't been accomplished here, because we're always stuck in this small town mentality that, you know, Toronto is it's a big city, it's great and everything, but I also don't want to pay high property taxes. Well, then now we're seeing the results of that. And I think that's a lot of what Desmond focuses on is, things like social housing, poverty reduction, etc. And I think because he's so smart about all of this stuff and is so passionate about it, that him actually saying to people, well, yeah, unfortunately, your taxes do have to go up. Like, you've been riding it pretty easy for a lot of years, being able to have like paved roads and everything else. But what about this person over here that's not able to sleep indoors at nighttime? What about this person that needs a safe injection site? You know, what about this person that is just immigrated here from Sudan and needs mental health assistance. What about all these other people that you're not seeing included in the Toronto mainstream? And unfortunately, you know, people just don't respond well to that.
All right. Well, I want to go to the lighter side here for a bit.
You took this down a really dark
path. Yeah, I know.
I can't even think I was going to talk about Black Panther. Now I'm talking about poverty reduction.
let's get back to our nerd roots here. Star Trek Discovery premiered last year, and of course, Sinéad Quimbarton Green, one of the leads. Star Trek has always been, at least for a lot of nerds, it's always been a place of solace for people.
I'm gonna be perfectly honest, man. I'm a big Star Trek fan. My mother and I went to go see the season or the series conclusion of Star Trek at the Sky Dome, back when it was called the Sky Dome. I've been into Star Trek like my entire life. Deep Space Nine was like my favorite series out of all of them, and I just haven't been able to watch this current iteration of Star Trek. Yeah, I was about to say Enterprise. I'm like, no, that's a terrible Scott Bakula one that we're trying to forget about. I haven't been able to watch Star Trek Discovery at all. I haven't had the time lately. I've got like twins on the way, and I'm like re-educating myself, and I've got like a bunch of writing assignments, and I just haven't had time for my all important geek stuff. I haven't really seen it. So just keep in mind, whatever answer I give you is going to be from a position of someone who's only seen the trailers.
But I think what I was going to say is, do you think in terms of, because there are a lot of black nerds out there, having Sinéad Quimbarton Green in a lead role in a franchise as iconic as Star Trek?
Yeah, well, I would say that that's important, but, you know, Deep Space Nine also exists, you know, and the commander of Deep Space Nine was commander and then Captain Benjamin Sisko, who was, I mean, the thing was, because, oh my gosh, John Avery was really, I guess, well-regarded in the black community because he had been in several TV shows before that, playing like a hero cop type character, right? So he was like a very, like, well-known figure in the community, and then he ends up on Deep Space Nine, which I think was like a bridge for a lot of people who weren't necessarily into Star Trek The Next Generation, but to get into the Star Trek series. One thing I really liked about it. Oh, sorry, gotta get that.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
My name is Doris. I'm just canvassing for Lee Koo, who is running for the role of provincial.
Okay, I'm not registered here, but the landlord's not home right now.
Oh, okay.
So. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
No worries. Sorry about that.
This is NDP territory. What's going on with y'all? All right, yeah, sorry about that. So the point I was trying to make here is that I think that the Star Trek series had already, black folks were already on board with Star Trek because many of us who were around for Deep Space Nine were, like, big fans of Deep Space Nine. And that's not to take anything away from Sinéad Quimbarton Green. I kind of feel like we were there already. Like we were already on board.
We've already established that you're a Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
who is your favorite Doctor?
David Tennant. Yeah. I say that grudgingly because he's everyone's favorite Doctor. So I want to be cool and be like, well, Tom Baker. But actually, I think I don't know. A lot of people like Matt Smith also, and I'm a big fan of his Doctor. I just happen to like the combination of Russell T. Davies stories and David Tennant as a Doctor. I thought that was just an amazing combination that made the show so awesome.
Are you excited for Jodie Whittaker, the first female Doctor, to take over? Because I remember I talked with one Doctor Who fan years ago, and he was of the opinion that he's just not sure in the actual storyline how a female Doctor, like how well that would work. But I personally, I'm a huge fan of it.
Well, I forget the name of the Doctor who he dressed like an English cricketer and he had the celery on his lapel. I forget the name of the guy who played him.
Is that Peter Davison?
Yeah. So and he was actually against. He wasn't a fan of a female Doctor.
Which is interesting because his daughter, who is named Georgia, was in an episode called The Doctor's Daughter, is now married to David Tennant.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That was his. No way.
And there's have you seen the Time Crash episode with David Tennant and Peter Davison and the things collide? Yeah, that's his father-in-law.
Oh, shoot. I didn't know that. Okay. Well, that being said, here's what I appreciate about there being a woman doctor is that While, I mean, we knew that Gallifreyans could change genders at any point because we saw the master become the mistress. What I didn't appreciate, though, with Stephen Moffat's writing was that... tell me about this. He has a tendency towards... making women characters like swing wildly from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum. So it's like they're like they can be like meek, like damsels in distress, or they can be like hyper competent women who are just like so far ahead of the rest of us. And then there's just to me at least it just seemed like there was no relatability for women characters to be women characters without having to like fit into these archetypes. And what I appreciate, you know, in the current iteration of the Doctor, is that it's not just going to be like this master mistress type of there's not going to be that dynamic. It just seems like it's the Doctor and the Doctor's woman.
I know at one point, I think between 9 and 10, Patterson Joseph was being considered for an incarnation of the Doctor. Do you think we'll ever see a Black Doctor?
Possibly. I actually, what I would have really appreciated was the current Doctor being a Black woman. That would have been great. But, you know, I guess in everything where it comes to film, there's always those baby steps. It always has to be a white man, then a white woman, then a Black man, then a Black woman. And, you know, that's just generally the way it goes. I just think that there's a lot of British actresses that would have made an amazing... As a matter of fact, Freema Agyeman, who was the...
Martha, yeah.
I actually thought she would have... I thought the roles... would have been awesome reversed. When Martha was the companion and David Tennant was the Doctor, I just remember watching those episodes and thinking, no, Martha should be the Doctor. I thought she would have made an amazing Doctor, but, you know, that's the way it goes.
What did you make of Bill as a companion in the last season?
I actually didn't watch... So that, like, spate of not being able to watch TV, that encompassed the last season, so unfortunately. And I'm told it was a really good season, but I wasn't able to see it.
Yeah. Well, people like Bill because she was Black... and she was a lesbian, and she was lower class. So, yeah. But at the same time, people's like, well, maybe this is just Moffat trying to make nice, because I think I know a lot of Who and Sherlock fans have issues with Moffat's writing.
I do too. I actually, I don't know. I think Stephen Moffat is a great writer, but he also has blind spots that you could just like drive a truck through, and that's, you know, race and gender happens to be major blind spots for somebody who writes shows that are very heavily steeped in both race and gender. So it's great to see that, you know, it's great to see a character that's out of type for him make it onto one of his shows. I just didn't happen to see the last season, so I can't really form an opinion on it.
The other franchise, if you will, that was being touted that they might have a first Black person is Bond, and they were talking about Idris Elba.
Oh my gosh, they've been talking about this since before Skyfall,
since before Craig, right?
Because Idris Elba was on The Wire back then, and he wasn't really that well known. But there had been talk about a Black Bond, I think, since about Quantum of Solace, and then I think between Quantum of Solace and Skyfall was the next one after that, right?
Yeah.
That's when I heard Idris Elba being bandied about. And I remember being a little bit disappointed because in Skyfall, James Bond visits his family's home in Scotland, and you can actually see like the name Bond is written on like a hanging sign or whatever. So I was like, okay, so this is actually James Bond. This idea that there's a James Bond like character which they slot different people into was completely blown away by Skyfall. I don't think that Idris Elba should be James Bond right now. First, I think he's a little bit old for the role, and I think that people's fixation on one person, because Idris Elba generally doesn't lead his own movies. He tends to be a supporting character. And I think people generally fixate on him because he's just like this rugged, masculine Black dude that is also very, very attractive. But I think fixating on him also takes away from like this whole spectrum of other Black actors that would be excellent for the role that are never going to be considered because everyone's just fixated on this one guy.
What about someone like Daniel Kaluuya?
I was just getting to him.
Yes!
I hate your guts. Because when I saw Daniel Kaluuya in... he was in this movie called Sicario with...
Emily Blunt?
Emily Blunt and Benicio del Toro. It was this movie about these drug investigators that ended up having to go to Mexico to get this drug lord. And Daniel Kaluuya's character in that movie was just so, like, it was quiet but still powerful. And I thought, this guy would make an excellent James Bond. Like, he looks right for the role. And now that he's gotten so much more attention because of Get Out, maybe that'll be a thing that happens. But I don't know. I could see casting a black James Bond going completely sideways. But I also thought that the Black Panther movie was going to go completely sideways. And here we are.
What about somebody like John Boyega? Or is he too ingrained now in Star Wars to get involved in another franchise?
Yeah, I think that putting a Star Wars guy in James Bond's suit wouldn't really go over well with fans. And especially because you're then bringing over the toxic fans from the Star Wars fan club over to James Bond. And I don't know. I could see the whole thing being a mess.
There was a rumor floated a little while ago that maybe they would go with Jill Bond or Jane Bond. Could you ever see that work?
Yeah, of course it could work. I mean, there's a if you like in the spy community, there is a lengthy history of women being like at the forefront of the spy movement. So I'm actually a little bit shocked that it hasn't happened already.
If you could choose a female Bond, would you want to go with somebody completely new, or would you want to do somebody like maybe like Keira Knightley or something?
I'd want to see somebody new. Get the role. Like, I'd want to see somebody that we hadn't really, because before Casino
Royale,
Daniel Craig wasn't that well known, and people were kind of up in arms because he was blonde, and a blonde James Bond was just not a done thing. Before that, he was in a film called Layer Cake, and then he just generally hadn't been very highly sought after before that. Like, he wasn't that well known, at least to mainstream audiences. So I would much rather see somebody new get the role and then be made a star by the Bond role than go with somebody that we already know.
Kind of like Sean Connery. Because that was his big thing, right?
Well, yeah, because he was a bodybuilder before that, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't this master thespian. So, I think that continuing that trend, like, I even thought that casting Pierce Brosnan for GoldenEye, I thought that that was a little bit of a cheat because he'd already gotten really popular from that show Remington Steele.
He was actually vetted before Dalton, and then he got Remington. So
was he?
Yeah, so after Moore left, or after, you know, because they had Lazenby and then Connery and then Moore, they wanted Pierce Brosnan. And then on the final day, they renewed Remington, so he couldn't do it, so they got Dalton.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then Dalton left, and they brought Brosnan back. So okay. I think maybe that's why that happened.
Yeah.
But
you see that there's a sort of a history there, that they bring in somebody who would just be really good for the role, but I think there's just been this history of not casting. And the only time that they ever did cast somebody whose face was widely known and then bombed the role was George Lazenby.
Yeah.
Right?
But also he was Australian too. Do you think that had something to do with it?
I don't think it was being Australian. I think that he's just, me personally, I thought he wasn't really an actor before that. You know, he was a model and his face was well known, but I don't think he was right for the role.
Yeah. You sort of alluded there to the toxic Star Wars fans, and you know, I've experienced this in their community. I'm wondering if you have too. There definitely is a certain toxic macho-ness that pervades the nerd community. What needs to be done about that?
I mean, I don't know that you really can do anything about it. I think what director Rian Johnson has done has been like pitch perfect. I think like all of the cast members of Star Wars who have been attacked, whether it's like Finn's character being attacked, or Rose Tico's character being attacked, or how is it that Luke Skywalker can project himself across time and space? That's not an actual Jedi ability. And then what Rian Johnson does was tweet a bunch of pictures, and he has like this actual Jedi handbook in his home, and he opens it up to the page where it shows, yeah, actually Jedi Masters have this power. Here it is. He took a picture of it. He's like, all right, we'll talk amongst yourselves. That was awesome. And I think that the approach that's been taken so far is the correct approach, which is you're not really going to be able to do anything about people like this. I think growing up as a black nerd kind of tempers you to some of this kind of behavior because you already, like, you're a margin within a margin, right? So generally, like, growing up in, like, the 80s and the 90s, like, nerd culture was just a really underground thing. Like, we played Dungeons & Dragons, like, at home in our basements. Like, you had to, like, find friends that were able to play Dungeons & Dragons or Magic the Gathering. And even in these games, in these books that we were reading, black people were just, like, portrayed as complete animals and savages. Like, so we had already been tempered to that kind of stuff, and being able to see ourselves represented in film was like, hey, awesome, that's really cool. But I think that for, I would say for a lot of white nerds especially, it's almost like something was being taken away from them. Because it's like, we had our own little thing going on, and it was really awesome, it was really cool, and we had, like, a a language and a dialect that we understood, like a secret handshake, and now the doors are wide open and everybody gets to just come into our club. And I think what a lot of them don't realize is that, well, no, like, I'm as much of a geek as you are. Like, I was into this stuff probably before you were even born, so who are you to tell me that I can't be represented? I think that requires a certain depth of maturity that a lot of them just aren't willing to ever get into. So there's not much you can really do about them besides ignore them.
I was frankly surprised at a lot of, you know, how polarized Last Jedi was among fans and a lot of the hate it got. Did you enjoy the film?
I actually loved it.
Me too. I loved it.
I loved it from beginning to end. And a lot of people talked about, you know, the side quest in the Canto Bight being completely unnecessary because it turns out that mission wasn't even successful anyway. No, because it actually helped two characters completely, like, it fleshed out two characters that we didn't know that much about, right? So whereas Rose was just like this really hopeful character who was just kind of like meek and lived in her sister's shadow, like, it helped her become a hero. And then Finn, who was just basically trying to get as far away from the Empire as possible, helped him understand, like, the value of being able to do something for someone other than himself.
Right.
So, and the fact that Rey turns out that she wasn't, like, descended from this long line of Jedis. That her parents were, like, scrap traders who, you know, traded her away for drinks. And at the end of the film, you know, watching one of the children that was sweeping up the stables at that casino, and he, you know, puts his hand out, and the broom moves from the wall to his hand so he can sweep up the floor. It shows that, like, that's what the series is all about. Like, anybody can become a Jedi. You know, you don't end up becoming, like, this all-powerful human being because of your lineage, because I thought that that's what the story was supposed to not be about. So I thought that that was a bit of a coup, because I felt like even though the world or the universe of Star Wars was massive in scope, it was also very, 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 very narrow in its storytelling. And I think that The Last Jedi was able to break out of that.
People are saying that maybe the kid in the end, after Episode 9, he'll be the star of the next trilogy.
Maybe. Who knows? that'd be cool, you know. But I just enjoyed the story for what it was. I thought it was a way for the current trilogy to break away from its predecessors, especially because that was the highest criticism that the previous movie had gotten. And I enjoyed it from beginning to end.
Are you looking forward to Solo?
Solo?
The Han Solo origin.
Oh, God, no.
Because it's not what it's just, I think it's just called Solo.
Yeah, I know. I don't pay attention to it because I don't need a story about Han Solo. I really don't. I feel like in a universe as expansive as the Star Wars universe, why do we keep coming back to the same characters? Like, why do we have to keep mining from that same, you know what I mean? Like, why do we have to keep going to that same source? Why can't we tell, like, other stories? And, you know, the extended universe, like the comic books and the novels and so forth, are huge, and there's so many more characters that we've seen that to me are, you know, super interesting. But in the movies, we always have to focus on the characters we already know. And the thing is, like, Star Wars came out of nowhere in the 1970s. Like, none of this mythology, like, I think for current fans who grew up on Star Wars, like, I grew up on Star Wars. I was born in 1980, so by the time I was born, like, two of the movies had already come out. I think that current fans who've sort of grown up with this lore are super familiar with the characters. But in the 1970s, when it came out, it was like a massive coup. It came out of nowhere. And I think we need more of that in our storytelling. Not to just keep on going back to the same, like, drawing from the same wells, pulling up the same characters, talking about their prequels and their after story. Just, no, find new people, new interesting people to talk about.
Is that why you think Rogue One worked? Because it was characters we hadn't seen?
I loved Rogue One because I didn't know anybody from that film, and I tried to pretend that Princess Leia and, what's
that name? Holdor?
Yeah. I mean, those were 3D animated characters, so I just tried to pretend that.
Not Holder. The Peter Cushing guy.
Yeah.
Him.
What the hell is his name again? Oh my god, my geek creds are going down.
I know, right? I can't even.
But anyway, I liked it for what it was because I didn't recognize any of those characters.
Right. I don't know. I wasn't a big fan of the reanimation Peter Cushing because he was younger anyway. So that I felt like they could have got another actor. I think it was a little bit distracting for me.
It was.
Moff Tarkin, by the way.
Grand Moff Tarkin. Oh my gosh. How did I forget that?
So I don't know. I think I loved Rogue One. My only beef was when they brought, like, you think Cassian's dead, they bring him back and then they kill him again.
Yeah.
I get why everybody has to die, but then you kill your hero, you bring him back, and you kill him again. I don't know. I think maybe it cheapened. They're talking about doing a Boba Fett origin story.
Oh, God, no.
But what about if they did Mace Windu?
I wouldn't want to see that either.
No?
No, I just, no. Because, okay, so Mace, now you get me upset. Okay, so with Boba Fett, the thing that I found redeeming about his character is that we find out that this guy is actually not so special after all. Because, in the late 80s and 90s, when Star Wars had, completely taken over all media. By the mid-80s, Star Wars was everywhere. And everyone was really enamored with this Boba Fett guy. And everyone was angry that he got taken out in Return of the Jedi by just being knocked into the Sarlacc pit. Everyone was really upset about that. And I never understood, why is everyone so, sure he's a bounty hunter and he captured Han Solo and that's all well and good, but why are we so obsessed with this one person? And I think that what George Lucas did well, if he did anything well in the prequels, was helping people understand, this guy's not so special after all. He is a clone. And the person he was cloned from was also a flawed human being. Therefore, all the clones are going to be flawed. That's at least what I took from it. So I'm just not interested in exploring Boba Fett's backstory, because we have already explored Boba Fett's backstory. We know that he's a DNA stamp of a person that wasn't that great anyway.
Speaking of maybe franchise roles and having black actors portray them, what about either Superman or Batman? Is that something you think that could happen?
No.
No?
No. I don't think Superman or Batman's characters are really possible to do. There was actually a really good Marvel Comics imprint called Marvel Max. I say really good because I think Marvel Max is able to tell stories that hadn't really been told in the Marvel Universe before. And Marvel Max had this alternate version of their Squadron Supreme. So, and I think it was the late 1960s, early 70s, where Marvel had the superhero team called the Squadron Supreme, and they reimagined them as this completely rogue group of people that had superpowers and were brought together, but didn't really like each other. And that was called Supreme Power. And in Supreme Power, you had your Superman analog. His name was Hyperion. So he came from another planet, but rather than crash landing and being raised by a John and Martha Kent, he was raised by a couple of CIA agents, or maybe they were FBI, I don't know. But anyway, a couple of government agents that were playing a role. And they kind of shaped him into a Clark Kent type character, but he had this really dark underside. I could just completely own this planet if I wanted to. And you're very lucky that I'm holding myself in check. So it explored all the dark sides of those characters. They had a Lex Luthor on the team, an Aquaman type character, but it also had a Batman character. His name was Nighthawk. And Nighthawk was the son of he was the son of a multimillionaire family, but his parents weren't just murdered, they were lynched by racists. And so he grew up as a very angry, he grew up really resentful towards white people. Everything that he did in his life was for personal enrichment, but also for enrichment of his community. But he also did it to show white people how much they had no control over him. And so his character, Nighthawk, prowls the streets at nighttime, and not to just bring justice to the community, but he had a very specific focus on black communities and people who preyed on black and Hispanic communities. And I think that Nighthawk did a better job portraying what Batman would be like as a black person than DC would be capable of doing.
Speaking of Marvel, are you most excited for Jessica Jones season 2 or Luke Cage season 2?
Yeah, you know what? I like Jessica Jones a lot more than I thought I would. This Marvel Netflix, I'll give it a shot, whatever. I actually ended up really liking Jessica Jones, and then I spent a little bit of time thinking about it, and I was like, man, she's a really messed up human being. She completely messed with Luke Cage's mind, and I think that she crossed a lot of boundaries, but I'm interested to see what season 2 brings. I wouldn't say that I'm excited per se. I felt her story wasn't that well handled in season 1. There was a lot of things I liked about it, but there was a lot more that I didn't like about it. Luke Cage, I'm excited to see. I really wish that the fight scenes could be handled better, though. Because what we've seen in the Marvel Netflix series is something that I think Daredevil did really well in season one, but I think has like aged out as current iterations of the Daredevil series, but also other shows have gone on, which is like the long hallway fight. And Daredevil, I think, pulls from like a lot of 1980s action films. I call this like the Night of a Million Ninjas, where like one white character will go out like on a rooftop or something, and then they'll just be like bombarded with waves of ninjas from every corner, and they have to fight their way out of it. That was something that I grew up on, like cheesy 1980s action films, so I thought that was kind of cool. But I think the way that they've filmed the fight scenes in the shows has not aged well as it's gone along, and I think it really showed with Luke Cage, because here's this guy who's completely bulletproof. He's strong enough to like grab a 200-pound man and just throw him across the room with one hand. What chance do you have to fighting against him? But then like there's waves of people just running up to try and fight him, and he just like makes mincemeat of them all. So it's Luke Cage is just too OP for my liking. And I really hope that they find a way to make the fight scenes more interesting. I also hope they find a way to make his opponents more interesting, because I thought that Black Mariah and Diamondback were really cool characters at the beginning of the season. And then they gradually just... I think Diamondback's story came to an end a little bit too soon. I would have liked to see where his character went. And then they brought in Copperhead. And I think what really would have really worked is if they had switched the people who play those characters. I think if the guy who played, and I forget his name offhand, I remember him from Boardwalk Empire.
Mahershala Ali?
No, Mahershala Ali, he played Diamondback.
Oh, the guy, you're talking about the guy that played Copperhead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, no. Oh my gosh. Okay, no, so it was, I'm getting all my characters mixed up here. Cottonmouth was Mahershala Ali.
Yes.
Diamondback was, dude's name I forget, who was in Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
He played Don Pursley. So, if they had switched characters...
Oh, I see. Okay.
I think if Mahershala Ali played Diamondback, that would have been a really good way to finish off the season. Because A, you'd have Mahershala Ali coming back at some point.
Right.
And B, I think he looks a lot more like Luke Cage. And I know that they're not they're half-brothers. But I feel like there's a lot better chemistry between the two of them. Like, I could see how much like Luke Cage is like the tall, strong, like pillar of the community, the respectable black man. Like when you grow up, your mother points to him and be like, "Why can't you be more like Luke Cage? You gotta be more like him if you want to get somewhere in life." And then Cottonmouth, I think, is a character who like kind of became a product of his environment. He could have been something better, but he's mostly a product of his environment, and he thrives in the best way that he knows how. And I think that the dynamic between those two characters, like the black respectability versus the black criminality, I think bounced off each other so well at the beginning of the season that I was actually a bit disappointed when I didn't get to see how the season ended with that.
But how cool was it to see, I really enjoyed seeing Alfre Woodard in a villain as well, just because like, out of all the people you would expect in sort of like a Marvel Netflix, it's her, like, yeah. You know?
Not just Alfre Woodard, but just playing like a down low evil, like smile to your face but has the knife hiding behind her back kind of character. Like, I love seeing that. I loved her in that role so much, and I really want to see where, you know, where they go with her character. Like, because by the end of the season, she's completely embraced her criminality. Now she's Black Mariah. So I grew up watching her in like very respectable kind of films, like really she generally played characters who was just like the good guy, the matronly person, the person that'll help you when you're down, like, you know, the moms you can go to and knock on her, or you know, your aunt you can go to and knock on her door if you needed help. Like, she was that kind of, she played those roles mostly like a very matronly kind of character. So for her to play somebody who's as grimy as she was, I love that.
So speaking of Netflix, what is your current Netflix binge watch?
Oh man, I don't have the time for it. And I pay for Netflix and I don't get to use it because unfortunately I've just been so busy lately that I don't get to watch any TV. What's the last series that I binge watched? Oh man. I don't remember what I last binge watched. I think it might've been The Punisher.
Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't like that either. I thought that the problem with The Punisher was that the storytellers couldn't choose a side.
you can choose the side of this guy is bringing vengeance to people who deserve it. And sure, he's like got some unconventional methods of going about it. And yes, it's hyper-violent, but this is what we ultimately need in this universe. Then there's the soldier who goes off to war, comes back with PTSD, and maybe this person's not just, you know, gunning down criminals because of a need for justice. He's doing it because he's a very tortured individual who has like some serious psychological wounds and needs help. But you can't ride the fence between both of those. And I think they tried to do that and ultimately failed. I liked where they could have gone with it, but I didn't like the story at
all. I just felt it was, and I just found it really slow moving. Like the first, you're just like, come on already, move. Yeah, it was like, so slow.
I know. I remember like at the beginning of the show, I was like, man, I hope he's just not going to like, you know, make shooting people his only solution to everything. And then the first scene, you know, he's just like, he's shooting this guy from like a whole city away. Like he sniped the dude through a window. And he was, like, on the U.S. side of the border from Mexico. And I was like, okay, well, I guess they're getting into the gunplay really quick. And then, like, 2-3 episodes in, I'm like, when's he going to shoot somebody? It's taking forever for him to actually develop anywhere. But I really wish that they could have explored what his character is capable of. Like, I wish they'd have explored his humanity more than just him being this tortured war vet. Like, he's an actual human being. And I think they've done that really well. With Daredevil, they've done it like super well. Jessica Jones and Luke Cage, Iron Fist. We're not going to talk about because that show doesn't exist to me. But Punisher, I think that was some really high stakes that they failed at. And there's one scene that just made the whole season alive for me, which is when one of his friends in the support group, two of his friends in the support group, go to protest down by City Hall against a gun control bill. And they're passing out flyers, and a police officer comes up to them and tells them to get off the steps, like they're trespassing. And this pro-gun guy, like, gets in the officer's face, and then the officer basically takes him down. I was like, that would never happen. Like, a Second Amendment gun nut going to City Hall, passing out flyers, a police officer is really gonna? Nah, I don't think.
And a white pro-gun nut at that, right?
Yeah, I just, it was too, I could not stretch my imagination far enough to accept it.
So what is on your watch list, then?
Man, I don't have a watch list right now.
No? Too much?
I think if I was to watch, like, if I had some free time and I could sit down and watch anything right now, it would be Star Trek Discovery. Like, that's, I feel like I'm really missing out on something by not watching that show. I haven't seen Blackish past the second season. I haven't seen Black Lightning, and I was stoked for it because Black Lightning is, you know, one of those sort of memory hold DC characters that they introduced and then sort of pulled back and then made him like I would say like the story of Black Lightning is very similar to the way that Black Panther in Marvel Comics kind of showed up, then disappeared, then started showing up again, then became like an accessory character. And then because Marvel has like a large enough Black geek fan base that's just clamoring to see more of him, was able to like make him into a fully fleshed out character. I think that's what sort of happened with DC and Black Lightning. Because DC simply didn't have Black people in their comics. Like, they just didn't. So for him to be popular enough to not just have his own TV show, but a TV show that I think, at least on the face of it, looks like it's going to be more successful than The Flash or Arrow. Like, that's a huge cue to me. And unfortunately, I just don't have the time.
So overall, Marvel or DC?
Oh, man. That's tough. I'm going to say right now, I think DC has the edge. Like, I think DC is right now telling, but in the times that I can actually like get a comic book in front of my face and actually read it, I enjoy DC's stories more. I like what they've done with Superman, actually. I like how they've really brought him down to earth, made him realize that, like, and I think the way that they brought Bruce Wayne down to earth, basically he's got the son that completely hates him. Like, you can actually see what the toll that this guy's crime fighting past has taken on him personally. And just makes him a completely unfit parent. Whereas with Superman, you can see that crime fighting, it has a toll. And it's almost like he's pulling himself back a little bit from being like the protector of the planet. Because he's like, I got to be a father first.
Yeah.
So I like what they're doing with these characters. I think with Marvel, there's been a lot of turmoil as to which fan base they actually want to cater to. I think for a while, they were really going with, we have a diverse fan base, so let's actually cater to them. And then they put out these one-shots, where they put out a series, they don't support it very well, and then when it doesn't get picked up and it's showing lagging sales for even a moment, they'll yank it. So I think Marvel really has to figure out who their audience is and who they want to cater to
before they can really get my vote.
What do you make of the fact that Wonder Woman was shut out at the Oscars and sort of the Academy's lukewarm reception at best to superhero films?
You know, I hate to say this, man. I know it's not okay to say this, but I'm going to say it. I didn't like Wonder Woman that much.
No?
I thought it was all right. Like, I thought it was a good film. I think that, how am I going to put this? I liked Wonder Woman as a superhero film. I liked Patty Jenkins as a superhero director. I thought the last act of Wonder Woman completely fell apart. And I was just like, nah, like, come on, fam. Like, really? The line from David Thewlis playing Ares, trying to coax Wonder Woman to his side, and then she refuses, and he's like, "Well, then I will destroy you." I was like, "Oh my god, this is everything that I'm afraid superheroes are going to be, or superhero movies will be," because people who like kind of crapped all over the idea of superhero films being tentpole films, like that's what they were saying. This is what our movie industry is turning into, like these just gigantic spectacles that are just empty calories. And I thought the last third of Wonder Woman was entirely that. So I thought it was all right, but I wasn't like wowed by it. And yeah, I don't really know that I was really considering it an Oscar caliber film.
Kevin Feige finally announced that they're going to make a Black Widow solo movie. Excited?
Yeah, he can keep it. I'm not that excited by it. I'm just not. Because I didn't really like Black Widow the character in the comic books. I didn't really understand what role she played in the Avengers besides having a lot of conflicting loyalties that just kind of messed her up for the team. So I'm more excited for the Captain Marvel movie. I was really hoping that there will be like a small scene or like a little wink to the audience where, you know, Captain Marvel like comes back to Earth and fights whatever like intergalactic fight she has to fight. And then like she's in New Jersey somewhere. And then, like, she's just, like, walking through the streets, and a Pakistani-American teen looks at her, and, she, like, gets stars in her eyes. And that's, like, the wink towards Ms. Marvel. I'm not really that excited for Black Widow, to be perfectly honest.
What about Infinity War? You talked earlier about spectacle, and it seems like Infinity War might just be too big. Like, because it's literally got every person who's ever appeared in the Marvel Cinematic Universe in it.
Yeah.
For the most part.
That's what the Infinity War was in the comic books. Like, it was just... I forget how old I was when I first read the Infinity War books. I wasn't double digits yet, I don't think. And I remember like thinking to myself, are they even allowed to do this? Like, oh my god, they killed Spider-Man. There was so much that happened, and like Thanos that had the Infinity Gauntlet, and like in the blink of an eye, he like wipes out half the population of the universe. I was like, they're not allowed to do that in comics. So it was something that I just hadn't seen before. But there was a long build-up to that. Like, Marvel had gone through, like, it's, like, outer space, it's like, space opera period. It had gone through, like, it was getting into its noir period. Like, there was a lot of stuff happening in Marvel Comics at that time that I only understand as an adult. It was like, wow, there's, like, a lot of work that went into this. And watching the Marvel films, because remember, Iron Man came out back in, what, like, 2006,
I think?
6 or 7?
Yeah.
From then till, so this is, like, you know, 11, 12 years later that we're seeing this. Yeah, this is the culmination of like about a decade of just hit after hit after hit. Like just amazing movies that when I was growing, like when I was a kid, I always thought to myself like, wow, it'd be really great to see a Captain America movie, or it'd be awesome to see a Spider-Man movie. But in my childhood mind, I knew that the technology did not exist to put that on the big screen. So to see not just like these Marvel films, but then the Infinity Gauntlet saga be on the big screen. I don't care what anybody says about spectacle or whatever. I just want to see it. And the fact that when Thanos, because you know Thanos had, they kind of changed his look over the films that he made his small cameo appearances in. But the fact that he like comes out of this like this sort of space-time warp, walks out of it, kind of takes a look around. I'm not sure if it was Iron Man or Spider-Man that he beat down, but he swung on somebody and just like smashed him to the ground. I was like, yo, it's like he a prison convict that just came out. Like, yo, this is my yard. I thought that like Thanos is like the, remember Friday?
Yeah.
Thanos is like the Debo of the Marvel Universe. I'm just excited to see what he does.
Are you a fan of the casting of Josh Brolin?
I wasn't at first, but I am now. I I was kind of ambivalent about it because the only time that I'd ever seen or heard about him attached to a superhero film before that was Jonah Hex, and that film was trash. So I wasn't altogether confident, but so far I like what I see.
And now he's also going to be in Deadpool 2.
Now he's going to be in Deadpool 2 as Cable, and I actually, I'm like, man, that's selfish because I think that, what's his name, was it David Lang? He was the guy that played the bad dude, the general in Avatar.
Okay, yeah. Stephen Lang.
Stephen Lang, that's right. Sorry, I have trouble keeping my names together. But yeah, you know, and the thing is, because I remember the first time I saw Stephen Lang in a film was the Hannibal Lecter movie, Manhunter.
Right.
From way before, so like for him to go from like this overweight, like this really slimy reporter dude to end up like being like the bad guy in Avatar, I thought this guy would be a perfect fit for Cable. Except that he might be a bit old for the role, but he's also like he looks better in his age than I ever will at my current age. So I thought he would have been awesome for the role, and I was a little bit let down that he wasn't cast for Cable.
Do you think we'll ever see a DC versus Marvel movie?
Nah, I wouldn't want one.
No?
Don't think I thought the DC versus Marvel crossover, like, well, I mean, they'd had like multiple crossovers, but their big crossover event, I think it was in like 96. Or 97, somewhere. Anyway, in the mid-90s, I thought it was trash. I didn't like it at all. I didn't. And then they tried to make, like, the one guy who had, like, access to both the DC and Marvel universes, his name was Access. They tried to, like, make him into a hero, and it was garbage. I didn't like it at all.
Is there, you mentioned Captain Marvel, is there one other superhero that you would like to see on the big screen that hasn't made an appearance yet?
That would like to see on the big screen that hasn't made an appearance yet? I think that Vixen would be a real, like, I know she's in the Legends of Tomorrow universe. I haven't seen the current season of it, so I've only heard that she's on it. But I think that following up Black Panther with, because Vixen is also, I'm pretty sure her family is from, like, Kenya, if I'm not mistaken. I think having, because I'm a big fan of Afrofuturism and Afrofantasy, and I think that following up Marvel's Black Panther with DC's Vixen, like, showing how she got these powers and how she's able to use it. She's even, like, at some points able to wound Superman. The creative ways that she's able to use her powers. So Vixen is a character that basically has, like, all the powers of any animal that's ever existed, even, like, fantastical imaginary animals. So she can, like, have the strength of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, or if she's, like, in a dark area, she can use the bioluminescence of an anglerfish to generate light. She was even able to use it to, like, shoot lasers. So just, like, the creative ways that she's able to use her powers, I think, makes her, like, an awesome and interesting character. And I think, like, she actually would be one of those DC films that they put out and I don't think put a lot of marketing behind it or do much to really promote it beyond simply saying, hey, we're making a Vixen movie. I could see that happening. And then I could see people being so, like, because the Black Nerd fan base loves her so much that they end up turning that into a big DC hit.
And Maisie Richardson Sellers is great as Vixen, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's good. I got to meet her on set once in Vancouver.
Oh, so, no way.
Because I worked as PA on that film. So, yeah, she was an overnight shoot in a muddy New West warehouse at 2 in the morning. But she's great. Well, that about does it. You heard it here first. A Vixen superhero movie is going to be the next big hit. Andre Demise, thanks so much for taking the time to come over today and chat about all things nerdy and Black history and all that jazz, man.
Good to chop it up with you.
Ciao.